You're listening to Faith for Normal People, the only other God-ordained podcast on the internet.
I'm Pete Enns.
And I'm Jared Bias.
We've been working on our children's Bible for over a year, and it's a project we are extremely proud of. And guess what? The official release date for God's Stories as Told by God's Children is March 25th, so mark your calendars.
Informed by biblical scholarship, inclusive and deeply respectful of children's imagination and intelligence, God's Stories as Told by God's Children is the storybook Bible you'll wish you had when you were a kid.
It contains stories from over 50 contributors, and these biblical scholars, theologians, and practitioners represent diverse religious traditions, locations, and lived experiences, mirroring the many voices we find in the Bible. You'll find stories from the Hebrew Bible, Apocrypha, the New Testament, including age-appropriate information about the history and context, as well as conversation starters for each story.
With no underlying theological or denominational agenda, God's Stories, as Told by God's Children, allows parents to introduce children to their own beliefs and traditions in conversation with the stories found inside. It goes on sale March 25th, 2025, but in the meantime, you can get a free story download today at thebiblefornormalpeople.com/God's Stories. Today on Faith for Normal People, we're talking about the politics of evangelicalism with Sarah McCammon. Sarah is a national political correspondent for NPR and co-host of the NPR Politics podcast. Her work focuses on political, social, and cultural divides in America, including the intersections of politics and religion, which is relevant for today.
Sure is. And I mean, Sarah's been around. She's covered several presidential elections, including the 2016 campaign when she reported on the rise of Trump movements, divisions within the Republican Party over the future, and the role of religion in those debates. And she's also the author of The Ex-Evangelicals, a wonderful book, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church, which is what guides our conversation today.
Yeah, and don't forget to stay tuned at the end of the episode for Quiet Time, where we're going to reflect on the conversation we have together here. So I think that's it. Let's dive in.
It's not like evangelicals think that Trump is some devout Christian. I mean, they know that he's not. So they're not looking for him to be that. They're not. They're looking for him to be a champion for their agenda and their beliefs and their values, just to sort of feel seen, to feel like the culture that maybe once existed that they saw as more in line with the ideal will be preserved and maybe be restored. They're looking for him to do all of that for them, but not necessarily to be one of them. That'd be great, but it would be icing on the cake.
Dein altes Sofa zerfällt langsam und die Black Friday Angebote sind wirklich unschlagbar. Aber dein Gehalt kommt erst Anfang des Monats. Kein Problem. Mit der PayPal-Bezahlung nach 30 Tagen. So hast du jetzt mehr Spielraum beim Bezahlen und der Betrag wird nach 30 Tagen automatisch und kostenlos von deinem Konto oder deiner Karte abgebucht. Alle Infos auf paypal.de/30 Tage. PayPal es. Vorbehaltlich Kreditwürdigkeitsprüfung verfügbar mit deutschem PayPal-Konto für Einkäufe zwischen 1 und 2.000 Euro.
Hey Sarah.
Hi.
Welcome.
Good to talk
Welcome
to you
to
both.
Our podcast. Yeah, great. It's great to have you here. And let's just get started. Just tell us briefly, you know, what's your background in terms of Christianity so people can just sort of situate you a little bit better.
Yeah. So I didn't call myself an evangelical when I was growing up. I just called myself a Christian. We were just Bible believing Christians. People would say born again sometimes. But we were evangelical by, I think, any reasonable standard, theological or cultural. I grew up, I was born in the early 80s. So right at the beginning of the Reagan era, right at a time when the evangelical movement was increasingly becoming aligned with the Republican Party and a sort of political project. That was an important part of my childhood, but the big focus was on our faith, on our, you know, belief in Jesus and in the aspect, you know, a sort of an expression of that faith that involved evangelism in many cases, the idea that we should be sharing the good news, the gospel with people around us, both people that we knew and sometimes with people that we didn't know. And, you know, Kansas City, Missouri, so very Midwestern, you know, conservative. It was a white evangelical community, not exclusively, but overwhelmingly. And everything that went along with that, like I said, theologically and culturally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that may be one of the more evangelical things you could say was we're not evangelical. We didn't think of ourselves as evangelical. It's just called Christian, right?
Yeah.
That's how it was for me. growing up too.
We're just Bible, but we just believe the Bible.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
We're just like Paul.
That's what, you know. Yeah, that's right. A direct line. I'm curious, within that upbringing, you know, what parts of that do you think continued to shape and influence you throughout your, I mean, even in, as maybe your faith has shifted, what are things that have continued to shape you, both kind of the good and the maybe not so good?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote a whole book about sort of why I don't consider myself an evangelical anymore and why a lot of other people use labels like ex-evangelical or mm-hmm. similar labels to talk about coming from that world and everything that that entails. But, you know, one of the things that I think I have given a lot of thought, especially in the past couple of years through the process of writing the book and talking about it with a lot of people, is the many, many really good things that I take away and continue to take with me from that that background. And I think a big one is just the belief in, you know, the image of God, the dignity of every human being, sort of God inside of or represented through, manifested in some way every person. I think that's a really beautiful idea and one that I hope on my best days compels me to see people around me lovingly and with hope and with respect. And, you know, a sort of a related idea, I think, if we believe that the image of God is in every person sort of bears and manifests the image of God, then I think that leads naturally into the idea of redemption, which is such a critical idea in Christianity, and the hope for redemption, right? The idea that nobody is lost completely, anybody can be forgiven, anybody can turn their life around. You know, I think that's a whole harder one to hold on to sometimes the longer you're on this planet, but it's a really beautiful and hopeful idea, and it's one I try to take with me. But I think you asked about the good and the bad. You know, obviously the bad is, anybody who has left church can probably relate to a lot of the bad things, and we can talk about them in more detail if you want. But for me, I could probably sum it all up as just fear, you know, fear of difference, fear of other people, fear of getting it wrong, fear of God, but not in the, you know, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom sense, but the terror kind of sense. And that's something that I think I still struggle with at times. But the more that I lean into the idea that God is good and God is loving, which is another essential idea of my childhood, the more that I, you know, that love casts out fear, right? to quote the Bible. The bad part is the fear. The good part is sort of the love.
Right. And those two things are often even still put together in evangelicalism. God loves you, but there's always the added, as long as you, you know, right. do X, Y, or Z, or say the proper prayer, or things like that. So, yeah, I mean, the fear is such a big motivating factor in a lot of religions, I think, not just evangelicalism.
For sure. And, you know, that's something I try to caveat. A lot of the things I say about growing up evangelical, my experience with evangelicalism, I don't think these are necessarily unique to evangelicalism, but that's my tradition. That's my world. And it is a uniquely kind of influential and important cultural and political force in the U.S. And so that's kind of why I talk about it and the perspective from which I talk about it. But I think it's a mistake to single it out as uniquely bad, because I don't think it is. And I think there are, I'm glad you asked about the good things, because I think there are many good things. And I think many of the bad things are shared by other religious traditions in their extremes.
Yeah. Right. So on that, can I just ask quickly about whether what role the Bible may have played too, and whether that's a good thing or bad thing?
Well, something that I'm sure none of your listeners will understand at all is that I have a very complicated relationship with the Bible. And I think that that's because the Bible is a complicated book. And if you, I think about it critically, it's hard not to see that and to feel that. And especially if you want to take it seriously, and if you grew up in a tradition that does take it seriously, and you want to honor that tradition, but you also want to honor reason and compassion and science and modernity and all the things that we also have access to. Yeah. So I think the Bible, I mean, I think about the Bible, I'm sure, every day of my, just about every day of my life. Like, Bible verses come to me at random moments. Mm-hmm. I quote them to my children who aren't especially religious. You know, they've been raised in the Christian tradition, but not in the way that I was, not steeped in it to the degree that I was. And sometimes scripture comforts me. But, you know, I also can't shake the memory of having verses quoted to me, you know, in ways that were very terrifying or in ways that felt divisive. Or even just being told, like, a good Christian reads their Bible every day. A good Christian has a devotional every day and wants to. And, like, my mother seemed to love it. Like, she got so much out of it. And I felt so much guilt because I would sit down with, like, my little, I had so many different Bibles, but I think of, like, my little purple Bible that I talk about in the book that had, you know, it was like King James. And I'd be, like, reading through it. And we didn't just do King James in my family, but, like, my Christian school did. So I had that influence a lot. And just reading through it, you know, trying to read through it like a book and just struggling, you know, like sitting on my bedroom floor at like seven and going, ah, you know, this is really boring and really confusing. And so it's, you know, I don't want to say a love-hate relationship. That sounds so strong, but it's a complicated relationship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's relatable to a lot of our listeners for sure. I want to maybe take a left turn because you mentioned politics. And one of the things that we wanted to talk to you about, just because of your background, is this marriage of evangelicalism and support for Donald Trump. And I'm curious if you can give like a good faith explanation. I'm always looking for kind of good faith explanations because whenever we're online and social media, people are all about giving kind of straw men and it's not always that helpful. But what's a good faith explanation for why evangelicals have been so supportive of Trump? Because I grew up, it sounds like we could have just exchanged the Midwest for small town Texas. And that what you just described is my upbringing as well. And it still is like, it's confusing to me. And so I still don't get it. And I want to get it in a way that I think a lot of people like me have family members and close friends who are still in that world who are supportive of Trump. In a way it's hard for me to connect. So can you maybe explain that to us?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to give myself too much credit, but I like to think, you know, I'm a journalist first and foremost. And so I try to just describe things like factually as much as I can. And of course, we all filter things through our experiences. And so, you know, I hope that everything, I try to make everything in good faith in the sense that it's as attached to the truth as I know how to make it. But I really think I think the answer lies in some of the things that I remember from my childhood and probably a lot of people who have people close to them or who grew up in the evangelical world may remember as well, which is this really complicated sense that, you know, as strange as it might sound to an outsider or to somebody who looks at data or looks at the cultural influence of evangelicals, there was this sense that we were kind of this embattled minority, this like persecuted minority, you know, and some of that comes from the Bible, from the way that Jesus talked about being a Christian, obviously speaking to a very different context when he talked about that. And of course, he wasn't even talking about being a Christian. He was talking about being a follower of God or him or whatever you want to say it. But, you know, what we take to be Jesus's words about following God and Christianity. You know, so people kind of then take those and apply them to our context, which is a fraught and questionable thing to do in the first place. It may be appropriate at times, but it may not. And then this idea that, you know, we were sort of, you know, everyone was looking down on us. Everyone was, the country and the culture was moving in a bad direction. You know, I heard those things all the time. And I think Trump echoed a lot of those things, right? Mm-hmm. The idea that like, Christianity is under siege. You know, make America great again. Some people thought that was just purely about racism and going back to a white America. And I can see why people saw that. But I think in the minds of a lot of evangelicals who didn't have, white evangelicals didn't have the same, you know, racial history, had not suffered that oppression. Maybe we're willfully blind to it. Maybe we're just had a different experience. However you want to explain that. You know, they looked and they said there was a time when we lived, the country was more traditional, marriage between a man and a woman, the fathers sort of were in charge of the family, everybody was happy. And I mean, this is the vision of the ideal family that I grew up with. You know, it's not, I'm not saying it's a good one or the right one or advocating it in any way, but I think this is sort of like the vision of how, in the minds of a lot of evangelicals, of how God wants people to live. Mother, father, children, this is like God's formula for happiness or something like that. And so you see the culture becoming more progressive, more open to women having rights, working outside the home, obviously legalized abortion, same-sex marriage. All of these things sort of violate the conservative Christian idea of how things should be. But I think there are, for a more progressive person, there are things that a lot of people would look at in the culture and agree that there are problems, right? I mean, there's this today, this huge epidemic of loneliness and isolation. Our country is struggling with drug addiction, and I think evangelicals have sort of mapped those problems onto their vision of what's wrong with the country. You know, like there's a correlation that's sort of portrayed as a causation. And I think Trump sort of harnessed all of that fear and all of that angst about how the culture's changed, where the country's going. We live in a country, again, where there's just massive economic inequality. And it's easy for people, I think it's easier for people of a lot of different backgrounds and persuasions to look around and say, like, something's off, something's wrong, things aren't going so well. Evangelicals look at that and they feel that feeling and they say, it's because we've strayed from God's way. Mm-hmm. So when Trump taps into that rhetoric of restoring the country, bringing things back, people hear that way and they resonate with it in a certain way. Trump also, I think he promised to do a lot of things that conservative Christians wanted. Obviously, overturning Roe v. Wade would be the sort of the paradigmatic mm-hmm. example. But what a lot of conservative voters tell me is that they feel like Trump and the Republican Party speak to religion and respect religion in a way that they don't feel seen and respected by Democrats. And we could go into why that is, but that is the feeling, that is the perception. And so it really is about like sort of two different pictures of what America should be, is going to be, is about. And Trump's painted a picture for many evangelicals that resonates with their own. Mm-hmm. And he's delivered on a lot of those promises, right? I mean, the first time he was president, he appointed three conservative Supreme Court justices that led to the overturning of Roe and a lot of other changes that, you know, may still come to pass.
And something you said too came to mind around when there's these problems in our culture, there's problems in our society, and you mentioned turning away from God is that problem. I think there's also this, at least for me growing up, the idea that sort of getting saved or becoming a Christian is the solution to all of your problems. And so that is tied to, well, if everyone would just become a Christian, all of our problems would be solved. And we have this sort of liberal progressive agenda that's getting people to not be Christians, which is against what the solution is to all of our problems, like mm-hmm. holiness, you know, loneliness, homelessness, drug addiction, all of that in my tradition would have been like, well, yeah, it's, if mm-hmm. you get saved, Jesus kind of takes care of all that for you. Right. And that maybe it, another reason I think that this sells is I feel like Trump does a good job of selling simple solutions to very complicated problems. And sort of for me, I would have been prepped for that kind of mm-hmm. way of thinking.
I think that's really true. Yeah. And I mean, I'll hear things for years now when I've gone to many Trump rallies, not so many this past campaign cycle, but many, many Trump rallies in 2016. And, you hear things like, you know, we have problems in our country because we took prayer out of schools. We took God out of our country. We took God out of the education system. I think there was, I can't remember which mass shooting it was, but when Trump was president and Mike Pence, who of course is an evangelical, was vice president, I remember he said something like, he talked about the evil in the world. And I picked up on that because it was like, you know, he expressed condolences, but also talked about just, you know, the suffering that people experience because of evil in the world. And there's just this attitude, there's few that, you know, there are sort of fundamental rules that the world works by that we understand as Christians, as readers of the Bible in a certain way. And the reason that so many things go wrong is because people don't understand them, don't apply them properly. And mm-hmm. I think you're right, Jared. I think a lot of it is, it does tend to prime people for simple answers. And Trump is really good at marketing those.
Lust auf besonders feine Weihnachten? Erlebe einzigartigen Genuss mit Rewe Feine Welt. Diese Woche zum Beispiel Rewe Feine Welt Schweizer Käse Trüffeltraum mildwürzig, je 150 Gramm Packung, nur 3,49 Euro. Oder Rewe Feine Welt italienischer Prosciutto Crudo, roher Schinken mit Meersalz behandelt, mindestens 18 Monate gereift, je 100 Gramm Packung nur 4,29 Euro. Festlich sparen mit Genuss. Rewe, dein Markt.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
And, you know, I think just backing up for a second, another factor, you know, the elephant in the room is America is a Christian nation. By rights, almost by divine rights, and it's important for us to get back to that. And like you were saying, Jared, that solves all our problems. If we can just get back to those, quote, Christian roots, which I don't even know what they are, but that would solve the problems. And I think they see in Trump, as you're saying, Sarah, a person who can bring that about, who can bring back those glory days. And I guess the jury's out whether that's going to happen or not.
Yeah, and I think one of the most interesting sort of data points about that is I get asked this question a lot. You know, why do evangelicals support Trump? He's so ungodly, whatever. And it's not like evangelicals think that Trump is some devout Christian. Mm-hmm. I mean, right. They know that he's not. I mean, was it Franklin Graham or Tony Perkins or somebody? I can't remember which evangelical leader. And I think a few of them have said something to the effect of, you know, we don't need a pastor, we need a president. Mm-hmm. And you hear things like that on the lips of rank and file voters as well. And so they're not looking for him to be that. They're mm-hmm. not. They're looking for him to be a champion for their agenda and their beliefs and their values, to sort of feel seen, to feel like the culture that maybe once existed that they saw as more in line with the ideal will be preserved and maybe be restored. They're looking for him to do all of that for them, but not necessarily to be one of them. That'd be mm-hmm. great, but it would be icing on the cake, I think is a good way of saying it.
So do you mm-hmm. think that explains the current, I mean, the recent election, the strong support that Trump had on a popular level, not just on the electoral level? And, you know, it wasn't just evangelicals who did this, right?
Not at all.
It seems like there's more going on here than what we're talking about now.
I think with any election, you have to look at not just like what's the product that's selling, but what's not selling.
Okay, and, right.
And, yeah. You know, and I think this was a fascinating election. White evangelicals still overwhelmingly supported Trump, you know, and I think about the same numbers as before, about 80%. So there wasn't any big change there. But the really, I think, surprising, maybe not that surprising if you've been talking to voters, but somewhat surprising result was how much other groups moved toward him. Mm-hmm. You know, this has been well documented, so I'll go over it quickly, but like Latino men, mm-hmm. majority voted for Trump. Latino women moved toward him, still a majority voted for Harris, but I think it was double digit movement. And we saw this kind of movement in almost every diverse demographic. Especially young Black men, Asian voters, all of the movement was toward Trump, which, you know, I think complicates the narrative about this just being about race or going back to a white Christian nation. I think that's a piece of it, for sure. But I think there's more going on. And, you know, of course, the economy was a major issue for a lot of these voters. Mm-hmm. We heard about that. I heard about that. My colleagues did while we were on the campaign trail. But I also heard about cultural issues. You know, mm-hmm. I went to a Latino church in Pennsylvania, evangelical church. People there came from like 14 different countries, including the U.S. I think 15, including the U.S. And almost everybody everybody I talked to was a Trump supporter. I can't say that everybody in the church was, but I talked to a lot of people. And, you know, most people had U.S. citizenship. Many of them were immigrants. Some were born in the U.S. But even a couple of people who didn't expressed support for Trump. And, you know, I heard about the economy. I heard about the price of groceries and gas, but I also heard about concerns about crime, even concerns about immigration, you know, which I think might be counterintuitive. But for these folks, they were culturally conservative. Many were American citizens. They're afraid of the same things that a lot of white Trump supporters were afraid of. And a couple of them talked about, you know, ideology around gender issues, things their kids were hearing in schools or things that were being talked about in schools around, you know, transgender issues. And they were uncomfortable with that. And so, you know, it's a big, increasingly diverse, increasingly complicated country. I think some of the religious messages that resonate with white evangelicals actually transcend white evangelicals increasingly as the evangelical movement becomes more diverse. And so it'll be really interesting to see where those numbers go in four more years.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like, too, there is a conflation of some of these things that maybe, I guess the word that comes to mind is Christian nationalism, but that's not the right, that's not really what I'm talking about. I'm talking about how our national interests and our Christian worldview get conflated. And I think that's part of this, too. Like when you talk about those issues that wouldn't be, you know, narrowly considered religious, but now because evangelicals kind of advocate for seeing all of life through the lens of faith, we start to have a broad net. So now immigration does become a religious issue in some form or fashion. There are, you know, pastors all over the place trying to connect those dots mm-hmm. and talk about how these things are a religious issue and tying it back to their faith more and more. So do you see that kind of broadening net where people, it is, I just kind of think sometimes there's like a, oh, well, there's the evangelical block, and then there's other people who are supporting Trump for these other reasons. But I think that evangelical block is more and more seeing these issues as religious issues, if that makes sense.
You know, I'd have to think more about whether or not like immigration and the economy fall into the religious lens. Mm-hmm. I mean, they don't, my instinct is not so much, although there could be an argument made that there is. But, mm-hmm. you know, I heard, like I mentioned, the transgender issue. I also heard about abortion. I mean, some of these just
right.
the kinds of culture war issues that white evangelicals have mobilized around forever seem to also be, there's an uptake, at least this is one reporting trip I'm talking about. But I think, you know, my instinct is that this translates more broadly than this one church I visited in Pennsylvania because of the way that the election results came out. And, you know, I spoke to essentially the Latino outreach director for the Faith and Freedom Coalition, which is, you know, a conservative political organizing group led by Ralph Reed, you know, formerly of the Christian Coalition, mm-hmm. longtime white evangelical activist and leader. And they have a really robust get out the vote campaign. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she told me that something like maybe a fifth or a quarter of their door knockers speak Spanish. They've made a really concerted effort to reach out to evangelical pastors. And so I think in the same way that you get in the Republican Party, in the religious right, a marriage of sort of socially conservative and fiscally conservative ideas, that seems to be spreading more broadly beyond just, you know, white evangelicals, right? White Christians. But, you know, the big caveat here is in four more years, you know, if the economy is, I don't know, if the economy stays strong or is perceived as strong under Trump, I think it'll be harder to sort of disentangle, like, what's culture, what's economy, what's, you know, other stuff.
Right, right.
That's a great point, yeah.
Well, and I think for me, I think what I was thinking of is when you mentioned economics, like in some of the circles where I have these conversations, it's like being a good steward is a good faith principle. Mm-hmm. And so that kind of covers over economic practices around, you know, what does it mean to be a good steward with our resources? And that tends to line up with more conservative economic practices. And then that gets kind of lumped in as like, we want to be good stewards of our economy and of our resources.
And not send money to Ukraine.
Right, things like that. Right? Yeah, right, exactly. Right, yeah. Yeah. So you mentioned, we talked about Republicans generally. Can maybe we talk for a minute about on the flip side, just because you know, have probably a bit more of an insider perspective on this. How would you say the Republican Party views evangelicals? Like, I'm always curious, how sincere, which is a tough question for you to answer, of course, but, you know, are we using this label as a voting block to increase votes? Like, what data do we have out there to say how the Republican Party views evangelicals?
I mean, I think that's a that's a big question. So I remember one of the things I write about is back in the 90s when I was a teenager. I remember James Dobson, you know, the prominent evangelical leader, started out as a psychologist and moved into becoming a political activist, really, and among other things. James Dobson sort of led this, I don't want to call it a revolt quite, but you know, raised a lot of concern about the fact that, you know, he didn't see the Republican Party essentially as courting evangelicals sufficiently. He was unhappy with the vice presidential pick that year for having, I think, some history of pro-choice remarks. And, you know, this is something I heard growing up too, this idea that like the Republican Party didn't appreciate Christians enough and that Christians weren't active enough. They needed to make their voices heard, you know, kind of went both directions. But I think that I don't think that, you know, evangelicals are like the redheaded stepchild of the GOP. I think they, in many ways, are just the core of it. I was looking at some data in preparation for this conversation from the General Social Survey and a piece by Ryan Burge, who does a lot of data analysis about evangelicalism. He's a researcher. And, you know, the percentage of Republicans who were evangelicals back in the 70s was, I can't remember the exact number, but it was pretty relatively small. And it's just grown and grown and grown since then. And so, you know, evangelicals, like 80% of evangelicals vote for Trump, right? But also, like, the Republican Party is increasingly dominated by evangelicals who make up, you know, yes, they're a voting bloc, but I think that they're a voting bloc because they turn out regularly, because they vote in lockstep, because they're reliable, and because they're organized. I mean, a minute ago, I mentioned like the Faith and Freedom Coalition, which has this massive get out the vote effort that is bigger each election cycle. You know, we're talking millions of sort of low propensity voters that they door knock and turn out on behalf of the Republican Party and Republican candidates. And so the evangelical movement is intertwined with the GOP today and is really critical to it. And, you know, it's been noted that Trump rallies increasingly feel sometimes like religious services or revivals. You know, they open with prayer very often, and they include sometimes religious songs and religious imagery. And so, you know, are there Republican leaders who are sort of cynical and dismissive of evangelical voters? Probably. I'm sure there have been, but they've become very powerful. And, you know, during Trump's first administration, prominent evangelical leaders of all stripes, you know, from the sort of charismatic movement to the more mainstream, the Southern Baptist movement and so forth, had quite a bit of access to the White House. And I would expect much the same the next time around.
Maybe, Sarah, if it's okay for you to maybe take your journalist hat and maybe just put it to the side for a second. I know that's hard to do, but where do you think this is going? I mean, we don't want to predict, but just in terms of trends, I mean, what can we expect in the next 2 years and next 4 years in terms of the continued influence of evangelicalism in American politics?
It's hard to say. I mean, as I'm sure you're well aware, the country is becoming less and less religious. The only really substantial growth in the category of if you look at, you know, charts and graphs and polls about religion in America, the only growth is in people who are not religious nuns, disaffiliation, unaffiliation. Everything else is pretty much shrinking. Certainly white Christianity is shrinking, and that includes white evangelicalism. And so, you know, one of the questions I have, I don't make a lot of predictions, but I like to ask a lot of questions, is what will that shrinking pool that the GOP has relied on for so long, what will that mean for the future of the Republican Party? Now, if you'd asked me that a couple years ago, I would have said, well, it's probably going to be really bad. But looking at the results of the 2024 election and the coalition that Trump won, according to analysis by Steve Kornacki at NBC, Trump got like 1 in 3 non-white voters. And so the Republican Party, I mean, has recognized for over a decade now that they needed to reach out to non-white voters and broaden the tent. Everybody thought that Trump would be the death knell for that with his rhetoric about minorities and especially immigrants. But that so far, after this election cycle, doesn't seem to be true. I think a lot will depend on whether the Democrats can regroup and create a message that sells, that sort of appeals to sort of center left, center right voters, centrists. I think that they may have scared off, you know, some sort of centrist voters who are just primarily worried about the economy and don't want to fight the culture wars. They may have to think about how to repackage the message and persuade voters that they really are, you know, the party for the working class as they used to be seen. And a lot will hinge, of course, on how Trump performs in the White House. You know, he has made a lot of promises. He's said a lot of things. He says a lot of things just about every day. And it's hard to know which ones are going to turn into policy. And if so, what those policies will mean for people on the ground. And so I think it's just impossible to predict. You know, if he steers the ship and the economy's strong and Democrats can't coalesce around a message, then I would expect more of the same. But I think it's an incredibly dynamic time, and anything can happen. So I don't know.
And if we've learned anything, it's that predictions haven't worked.
Yeah.
Right.
Again, I think this election upended so many expectations, but what exactly was doing the work there? And let's not forget that the Democrats were running with a candidate that only had 100 days to sell herself to the public. And, you know, with I think in many people's minds, a weakened president. And so, you know, that's obviously an important factor as well. Now, I mean, that's not really answering your question about what do white evangelicals do going forward. I don't see white evangelicals in any substantial way becoming less Republican anytime soon. I think that if Trump was going to scare them away, he would have done it by now. Mm-hmm. But, you know, increasingly, I think a lot of people argue that who pay attention to this kind of stuff, that evangelical is just increasingly a political sociological label. And so, you know, people who may hold some or all evangelical beliefs, but don't see themselves as aligned with MAGA, are less and less likely to call themselves an evangelical. They may just call themselves a Christian. Like I did as a kid.
Jeder meckert über den ÖPNV. Aber was steckt wirklich dahinter? Mit dem Podcast Ticket to Anywhere blickst du hinter die Kulissen des Nahverkehrs. Schauspieler Maximilian Mund reist zu seiner Oma, trifft spannende Menschen wie Malte Zierden oder Linda Zervakis und erklärt alles zu Bus und Bahn und wie sie besser werden können. Erlebe ein außergewöhnliches Audioerlebnis rund um unsere alltägliche Mobilität. Jetzt reinhören auf Spotify oder unter zukunftnahverkehr.de/podcast.
Achtung, es folgt eine wichtige Botschaft Ihres Mobilfunkanbieters.
Ey Mann, es gibt Leute, die drücken immer noch zu viel Knete ab.
Nein, nicht frisch.
Der Barra ist ja irgendwie smarter.
Ja, smart.
50 Gigabyte für nur 8,99.
Wenig Knete.
Ich zahle doch nicht mehr für weniger.
Nee. Das wäre auch schön blöd. Lebara, deine Knete, deine Entscheidung.
Nice.
Alle Details zu unseren Tarifen finden Sie unter lebara.de.
It also seems that it's not going to matter too much as evangelicalism declines like all these other religious groups, because it feels like just the people that I talk to who support Trump and have voted for Trump have largely done so for, even if they have an evangelical persuasion, or more increasingly people who are not evangelical, that's, you know, I feel like, I guess I would say economy is in some ways a deeper religion for a lot of people in our country. And so it's like that's really the driving force of it. It is not, even for people who would say they're evangelical, sometimes when I have those conversations, they're able to sort of set that aside and say, well, I'm voting for this for economic reasons. And so I just think they were able to capture that audience in the 80s and 90s and now into the, you know, 2000s. But now it seems like it's less of an important factor. And so in my mind, it seems like the evangelicalism of it is going to have less and less of a, it's going to be less and less important, I think. I don't know. What would you say to that?
I mean, I think evangelicals have been important recently because, again, they're just, they used to be one in three or I'm sorry, one in four or five Americans, depending on how you count. Now it's down to like 14% of the population. But again, you're talking about, I mean, that's a chunk, that's still a chunk of the population.
Right.
And like 80% of them vote Republican. Compare that to mainline or Catholic, white mainline Protestants and Catholics. It's something like 55% Republican. There's still like a Republican tilt, but not nearly so profoundly. And so, I mean, some of it is, it's not necessarily only about, well, all these evangelicals, all these people are evangelical and they really care about like abortion and gay marriage. It's also about just like, here is a reliable group of voters that you can turn out again and again and again, and they don't move. And, you know, in a country where there are so many small subgroups of people with all these different differing agendas, I mean, it's just like that you can just go, you know, get a big bucket of votes there if you can get evangelicals behind you. And and so I think it's, but yes, I mean, I think that the culture war issues probably will have less salience going forward. I don't know. I mean, it's in this country, in American politics, it's never about one thing, right? It's about motivating the people that will go to the polls. And so I think that's why you hear these kinds of culture war issues continuing to pop up. It's not that most Americans are all that motivated by like abortion or transgender issues. It's that a segment of Americans who are very politically engaged and vote at high rates are motivated by them.
Right. Yeah, that's a great point. Well, as we wrap up our time, maybe I can take another left turn into just a practical question. And that is all the stuff that we're talking about, how has that impacted you, your ability to have conversations with people who, I just think we have a lot of listeners who I would identify as, like you said, ex-evangelical, deconstructed Christians who are in relationship with a lot of people who voted for Trump, Republicans, and maybe don't themselves align that, but have a hard time relating, connecting, having conversations. How do we have constructive political conversations when religious identities are now so far apart for some of folks, you know, I guess a large part of our listeners, at least?
I think it's really hard for a lot of people. And it depends obviously on like what their relationship is to those people, how close do they need to be to them? How, you know, I mean, is it a casual conversation at the grocery store or is it like your family member? And, you know, I think with more casual connections as a journalist, something that I hope learned how to do is sort of listen actively and listen with sort of, you know, try to be as non-judgmental as possible and ask questions. You know, if someone says something offensive, sometimes I can, you know, rather than trying to argue with them, just ask a question and see where they go with it. But when it comes to people that you're close to and that there's like an emotional connection to and with whom those relationships can be a lot more fraught, it's tricky. And, you know, I write in the Ex-Evangelicals about a lot of different ways people have navigated that. You know, some people end up quite distant from family or friends when they would rather not be, but it's the only way to sort of maintain a boundary or a sanity. But a lot of people, I think, are able to navigate these difficult conversations. You know, I have, I talk to people who, you know, have, I think, very complex, sometimes even unspoken boundaries with family members about things they don't talk about and things they do talk about. And, you know, it's always, when you're close to someone, you want to be able to share as much of your life as possible. But I think sometimes it's not possible. But I guess I'll leave you with one more thought to answer that question, which is, you know, my own family is politically diverse. And, you know, on election day, the family thread got very quiet. And I was just kind of like waiting for somebody to say something. And all of a sudden, like the morning after the election, the text thread lit up. And I was like, oh, gosh, what is it? And I looked and it was my father, good Midwesterner, sharing a photo of the newly laid driveway in front of their house. He was very proud of it. And he didn't do it himself, but he had it done. And, you know, I just thought, you know, sometimes we can just talk about concrete and driveways and landscaping or in the last couple of weeks, snow. We don't have to talk about all this other stuff all the time. And, you know, that might sound like a cop out to some people who are like, you know, I know there's this idea that we all need to go talk to our families and confront them about their bad ideas. And sometimes that's true, but I don't think it's always true. And I think we have to choose our battles. And I think that we have to treat people with the same respect that we want them to treat us with. And mm-hmm. so not everything has to be a fight. That is something that I think I have learned as I've reached middle age.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we're just too tired to fight at this point.
Yeah. And maybe that's the big lesson to take away is rethinking our political rhetoric and how we engage other people and befriending those we disagree with and trying to move to a better place.
Yeah.
Alas, that's more than we can do on this episode, right, Jared?
That's true.
Yeah. Well, Sarah, listen, thank you so much for being with us. We had a great time talking with you and for taking the time to be with us. You're a busy person, so we really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's good to talk to you too.
And now for Quiet Time
with Pete and Jared. Sarah said a lot. There's a lot going on mm-hmm. politically, but what
are you saying? She talked too much?
Or? No, she didn't talk nearly enough. That's what I. But so, you know, what's something that maybe you're taking away from this conversation today, Jared?
Yeah, I mean, both of us, when we were reflecting on the conversation, talked about this fear factor that. A lot of the motivation for a lot of this comes from fear. And I think it's hard to identify. I think for me, I wouldn't have said that explicitly as a kid because it's not that I was mm-hmm. I was really feeling fear,
mm-hmm.
but a lot of the rhetoric for why we should be motivated to do things was because if we don't, bad things might happen.
Right.
Or bad things are already happening and we have to stop the bad consequences mm-hmm. of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just want to, for me, set that tone that when we talk about fear, it's not always like a cowardly hiding in the corner.
Right, no, yeah.
It's something a little bit more nuanced mm-hmm. than that. But what did you think about that, the fear piece?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think that's huge. And you mentioned, you know, you don't always recognize it as that, but right. it's a deeply motivating factor, I think, just in being human. And I remember, you know, years ago, a therapist asked me, what are you afraid of? Mm-hmm. I said, nothing really. And he goes, okay, so let's talk about that.
Okay, so first of all, you're lying to yourself.
Or you're just not aware.
Right.
You're not aware exactly. of how much you're afraid. And, mm-hmm. You know, I feel this is not a novel point, but that it has been used very effectively in recent years in political rhetoric. And probably not just recent years, but every political cycle, there's mm-hmm. fear. And fear motivates people to vote. And I think many Christians have been, that fear has been nurtured and exacerbated to the point where, you know, it's made a tremendous impact on American politics.
But, mm-hmm.
So maybe just knowing what we're afraid of and being able to articulate it and not just being sort of in reactive mode, but in responsive mode.
Yeah, you know, that ties into another point that we wanted to talk about, which is the rhetoric we use to talk about these. Because I think, mm-hmm. like you said, if we're being reactive, our language reflects that.
Right.
It reflects the reactivity, the polarized. When you're afraid of something, then you're going to be mm-hmm. angry at the people who are doing the thing that you're afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if I'm afraid that this particular candidate or this party is going to take this country in this direction, then the people who are for that, I'm going to be either afraid of or more likely angry at. And so being able to recognize the fear, I think is actually a good way mm-hmm. to move away from this kind of polarizing rhetoric.
Yeah, because fear leads to anger,
mm-hmm.
right?
Wait, where'd you
Yoda's
get that?
Right. He's out. Anger leads to
suffering. That's in the Bible, right?
Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering. So, did I do that pretty well?
That's pretty good.
I think I did it pretty
That's
well.
That's pretty good. So. But, I mean, I want to maybe play a little bit of devil's advocate on this, because I think some people will say it's not necessarily non-polarizing rhetoric. It is standing up for, with passion and with a righteous anger, the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we navigate? I mean, we've talked about this before. Yeah. Maybe I'm hoping you've come to some great enlightenment since the last time. But how do we navigate that? Because I'm probably more on the, yeah, let's move away from the polarizing rhetoric
mm-hmm.
because that's just more my nature. But I kind of have that in the back of my head of people right. who are like, well, that's a kind of a privileged position
mm-hmm.
because you're not maybe as impacted by some of these policy decisions as others.
And on the left and on the right, you know, people who are, you know, gay, who are feel threatened, their existence feels threatened as a result of this.
Right.
And they might rightly say to people like this, you're not going to suffer too much from certain policies, right? Or women, you know, you're not going to suffer too much. And I definitely see the point. I think there's a lot of wisdom that needs to be employed to know when to be sort of that black and white prophetic kind of figure, which has a definite place.
Right.
But I think in the recent context, American political context, it's very hard to have a reasoned discussion with people.
Right.
Right. And I think that's unfortunate. So I'm hoping that, and I don't know what this looks like, but I've sort of caught wind of it over the past few weeks. Will this encourage us to have different ways of engaging each other over things that mean an awful lot to us?
That's a good way of saying
and
that.
Not just polarizing. You know, we're not all prophets,
right?
There are prophets out there, and I've listened to them, and I'm glad they're there,
right?
But how can I help enact change? And it is probably not by demonizing, which is another way of putting it, right? Yep. Demonizing people. I don't want to do that. I have people in my life who are politically very different than I am, and we get along, right? Nothing's going to change by my demonizing them, right? So I guess it's one thing to have a political rhetoric that is prophetic, let's say, towards issues and towards policies and maybe towards certain limited individuals, but not towards everyone who happens to maybe feel aligned with some of those principles, right? Even though I think they might be wrong, they are more than just that. I'm more than just what I think in terms of politics. And that gets lost very quickly in this rhetoric. So I'm hoping that changes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think for me, part of that too is how much of our behavior, how much are we willing to sacrifice for that cause also plays into it. Because I think I'd be frustrated where we substitute the rhetoric, like how angry I can get and how many people I can cut off is my social justice. It is my
virtue signaling.
It's sort of like that is what I'm about. And that shows, rather than, well, I'm doing all of these things and then I have a very principled understanding of how I'm interacting with people based on this body of work where I'm showing up and I'm doing the things in the world that may actually enact policy change. Right. So that's kind of my,
and I hate to be that guy, but it's social media hasn't helped.
Right.
The way people use it at least hasn't helped. And it's a chance to vent anonymously and things like that.
Well, that's a great segue into, I think the last thing we wanted to maybe discuss and unpack a little bit, which was the idea that, this is complex stuff. Like there aren't simple answers. And I think social media doesn't help that, where everybody has like a simple fix to whatever these complex problems are.
Right. And just judging by some of the things that Sarah said in the episode, it's really hard to put people in boxes. You know, I mean, you know, AOC talked about how people voted for her who also voted for Trump. And it's interesting, you know, that's sort of Rex categories. So this whole landscape is getting much more complicated. And I think maybe the last thing to do in that sort of situation is to become more polarizing.
Well, because polarization, I think, is a simplification.
Yes, right.
And I'm all for making it more complicated, because I think the issues are more complicated. I think our world is complicated.
Right.
So, yeah, I think those things, to recognize the complexity, I think, is to counter the polarization.
Right, right. And enough people have to do that, right? Not just 5% or 1%, but like most.
Right, which kind of goes back to, that's hard to do with fear.
Right. Exactly right. Yeah.
It's hard to have that kind of front of brain thinking and thought process whenever you're being driven by fear.
Yeah. So maybe we're at a tipping point or a shift, a paradigm shift, or whatever we want to call it, and we'll see what the future brings. I don't know.
Yeah, we'll see. Well, thanks to everyone who supports the show. If you want to support what we do, there are three ways you can do it. One, if you just want to give a little money, go to thebibleformalpeople.com/give.
And if you want to support us and want an all-access pass to our classes, ad-free live stream of the podcast, and a thoughtful community of people asking tough questions about the Bible and faith, you can become a member of our online community, the Society of Normal People, at thebibleformnormalpeople.com/join.
And lastly, it goes a long way if you just wanted to rate the podcast, leave a review, and tell others about our show. In addition, you can let us know what you thought about the episode by emailing us at info@thebibleformnormalpeople.com.
You've just made it through another episode of Faith for Normal People. Don't forget you can catch our other show, The Bible for Normal People, in the same feed wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was brought to you by the Bible for Normal People team. Brittany Hodge, Stephen Henning, Joel Limbowen, Savannah Locke, Melissa Yando, Tessa Stoltz, Danny Wong, Lauren O'Connell, and Naomi Gonzalez.
Just leave it on that dramatic pause. Ba-ba. We'll see. Ba-ba.